Good afternoon. My name is Wendy, and I will be your conference operator. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the 2010 State of Supportive Housing Industry Conference Call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct an interactive question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star, then the number 2. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jacqueline Anderson. Thank you. Ms. Anderson, you may begin your conference.
Okay. Thank you, Wendy. Welcome, everyone, to this month's CSH Hot Topics call entitled Forging Ahead, the State of Supportive Housing Industry in 2010. As Wendy said, my name is Jackie Anderson, and I am a Senior Program Manager at CSH in charge of our national research and evaluation work. On today's call, we will be talking about the results from a survey that CSH conducted with our nonprofit and government partners designed to better understand the challenges, opportunities, trends, and issues that the supportive housing industry is currently facing. I'm joined by three other presenters today. Richard Cho, also from CSH, is the director of our Innovations and Research Unit. Barbara Geller is the Director of Statewide Services for the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is the agency that has spearheaded the effort to expand supportive housing in the state of Connecticut for the past 15 years. Barbara has extensive experience in government at the federal level in both the executive and congressional capacities, as well as at the state and local level. And then finally, Daniel Malone is with us. He's the Director of Housing Programs for Downtown Emergency Service Center in Seattle, Washington. Daniel oversees an array of permanent supportive housing and emergency shelter programs, all targeted to chronically homeless men and women with severe disabling conditions. At DESC since 1989, Daniel is involved in all aspects of program development, including capital financing, implementation, operation, and evaluation of DESC's housing and shelter programs. So on today's call, Richard will provide some background on the purpose of the survey. I will give an overview of the survey findings, and then we will turn to Barbara and Daniel to provide some insight and reaction to the report from both a government and provider perspective. So the survey results that that we'll be presenting today are actually also are written up in a report that should be attached to everyone's invitation for the Hot Topics call. We have prepared a few questions in advance that we've asked both of the panelists to respond to. And then finally, we'll save some time at the end for questions and comments from the audience for probably the last 15 to 20 minutes. I'm glad everyone can join us for this call, and I will now turn it over to Richard to provide some background on the survey effort.
Great. Thank you, Jackie. As I think a lot of folks who are on this call know, the supportive housing industry is now more than two decades old. And as an industry that has 20 years behind us, we are now kind of at a critical moment. On the one hand, this industry has grown in sophistication. It's one of the few industries and policy communities that has knowledge across a broad set of areas, including social services, affordable housing development, property management, as well as public financing. And it's one of the few industries that also is focused on serving the most vulnerable subset of our nation's populations. And it's also unique in the sense that it consists of a really diverse cross-section of agencies and organizations representing everything from affordable housing and community development to mental health and substance abuse and behavioral health to public health to corrections and criminal justice, child welfare, and you name it. It really cuts across a large number of different policy sectors. We're at a crossroads and a kind of particular critical moment at this time, just as we were reaching our peak in terms of sophistication, where supportive housing was not only available and created in many communities, but it has also become an established part of ending chronic homelessness in the United States. Just at that moment, the economic recession hit, and many states were faced with pretty severe budget crises. And whereas in the years prior to this crisis, supportive housing was enjoying greater levels of public investment, we're at a point now where the ability to sustain that level has been threatened. And I think with that concern and knowledge in mind, our president at CSH, Deborah DeSantis, really wanted to take a temperature of where the supportive housing industry was at 2010, and to really find out about the particular challenges, opportunities, and trends that the industry was facing. In particular, we were interested in learning about how the industry was feeling as both a cohesive industry, what their outlook was for supportive housing, both the intervention as well as the industry, as well as particular opportunities and innovations that the industry was focused on. We also wanted to learn a little bit more about the levels of funding and financing that were available to create and operate supportive housing, whether that's changed over time, as well as some of the challenges that communities are facing in trying to develop and create more supportive housing. And lastly, we really wanted to learn more about the levels of political support and whether or not that was changing in the face of very kind of difficult budget situations. So that's the broad overview of what we hope to achieve through this industry survey. As Jackie will mention, we had a pretty tremendous response and learned a great deal about where things are with the supportive housing industry at this moment. And based on that success and our response rate, we are hoping to try to do this on an annual basis. And so I urge everyone to look forward to future reports of the state of the supportive housing industry on an annual basis. So, Jackie, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, thanks, Richard. So as Richard mentioned, we really received a great response to the survey, and we really appreciate all of you who are on the phone right now who did respond. We had over 350 people who completed the survey. The respondents, I think, really well represented the supportive housing industry as a whole. Over two-thirds were from nonprofit providers, one-quarter from state and local government, and a small number of respondents from the federal government, foundations, and academic institutions. Along with that, you know, many different sectors, public sectors were represented. Two-thirds represented the housing sector. Close to half represented the mental health sector. Other sectors were well represented as well, including substance abuse, social services, and employment, and to a lesser extent, HIV/AIDS services, the criminal justice sector, veterans, aging and senior services, and youth. So, like I said, it was a really good response, and I think, you know, it's a great sort of cross section of the agencies and organizations that are involved in the supportive housing industry. So in terms of the findings, I think despite the current economic crisis, the majority of respondents were really optimistic about the state of the supportive housing industry in general, again with some caveats about, about sort of struggles with particularly sort of state and local funding, with the current economic crisis. But over two-thirds were very hopeful or somewhat hopeful about the future of the supportive housing industry. Over 90% agreed that supportive housing needs to be brought to more communities, and close to 80% agreed that supportive housing is a model with potential for solving complex social problems other than homelessness. The agencies and organizations represented in the survey are actively involved in many of the sort of innovate program and sort of funding innovations necessary to adapt the supportive housing model to new target populations and settings. Just as a few examples, 60% of the respondents said that their agency or organization was actively implementing housing first or harm reduction models. 49% were implementing integrated, affordable, and supportive housing models. 38% were implementing models for high users of crisis health services. 32% reentry models of supportive housing for people who are involved in the criminal justice system. And 23% were actually leveraging Medicaid and supportive housing. As to say, sort of despite this new innovation, I think funding availability continues to be a problem, and even more so, I think, with the often severe state and local budget constraints that many states and communities are facing. Over half of the respondents said that capital operating and services funding was less available than it was a year ago. So I think people really are sort of feeling the fallout, I think, from the economic crisis and state budget problems. In terms of the type of funding that's funding supportive housing, federal sources really continue to be a very important component for developing and operating supportive housing. On the capital side, the low-income housing tax credit is the most widely used source, but federal sources like HOME and CDBG are the second most commonly used source for capital. In terms of operating and supportive services, continuum of care funding, it tops the list, as well as Section 8 for operating subsidies. However, state and local funding sources are really playing a very significant role in many of the supportive housing projects that the respondents were involved in. And again, while there's considerable interest in tapping Medicaid for supportive housing and other mainstream sources, really only one-third of the respondents said that they were using these sources, and even less for other mainstream sources like TANF. So that is an area where I think the industry can be moving in terms of finding funding for future supportive housing projects. Respondents report a fairly high level of capacity along a variety of dimensions of operating supportive housing, particularly in the delivery of supportive services and case management, linking to mainstream health and behavioral health services, as well as benefits advocacy and citing new supportive housing projects. There are other areas where respondents felt like they had less capacity and can use some training, including tailoring services for individuals involved in the criminal justice system, as well as young adults, forming tenant councils, and obtaining tax credit equity. Respondents reported a fairly high level of commitment to supportive housing among public agencies, and this was particularly true for the mental health and housing sectors, but less so among elected officials. Respondents reported sort of a medium level of political support for supportive housing in their communities. And NIMBY issues really continue to be a problem, as three-quarters of the respondents reported they were currently experiencing community resistance to supportive housing. And then finally, while the cost effectiveness of supportive housing continues to be a major argument for the intervention, particularly during the economic downturn, arguments about sort of ending homelessness and reducing recidivism and improving health and mental health outcomes are also very important as well, as advocates and stakeholders really try to build political will across the country. So that's sort of a really brief overview of some of what's in the report. For those people who are interested in reading the whole thing, if you didn't get the link in the Hot Topics invitation, you can also find the report at our website, www.csh.org/hottopics. So it's available there as well. So now we'll turn it over to our final two panelists. Barbara and Dan, are you there?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, Dan. So like I said, Barbara Geller and Daniel Malone are here to sort of provide some perspective about these findings and sort of about the future of the support of the housing industry more broadly. So I have a series of about four questions that I'll pose to each of them, and then we'll have some time at the end to open the line for questions. So the first question is, we can start with Barbara, what did you find most interesting and or surprising about the findings of this report, and which of the key findings do you sort of most agree or disagree with?
Well, I must say that I was delighted that people, considering these economic times, are still as enthusiastic as they are about supportive housing and where it's going. I was equally interested in the concept of supportive housing widening its role in terms of new populations. Although we didn't expand too much on it, the whole concept of where we should go from here and what the world looks like, particularly in issues like the criminal justice system and young adults, although it was clear that folks felt they didn't have the capacity, the interests were there in terms of the possibilities of expanding supportive housing to meet the needs of populations that some of us may be serving in a small way, but obviously where the need is great. One of the things that did surprise me was that we didn't talk more about, and you mentioned this just a bit, Jackie, about new funding sources and the new healthcare reform. And it may be that this study was done a little bit before that, but how do we, particularly those of us who are involved in healthcare organizations or get some funding from healthcare organizations, how do we make housing a priority, and how do we make housing fit into what the priorities and the movement of the federal government is? So although people sort of mentioned that slightly, I was surprised that we're not thinking more about how do we make housing part of the way we look at treatment in new ways. The other piece that I was disturbed about was the fact that most people responded that community resistance to supportive housing has not changed. And one of the things I was wondering about was whether we were talking more about single site than scatter site models. I know that we have had in Connecticut a distinct difference in the effect of community resistance or the amount of community resistance relating to whether we're doing it in a scatter site or a single site manner. And there wasn't much discussion of the different models that you can use to counteract the whole NIMBY issue. The last thing that I was surprised at is that we're all at a point in supportive housing now where we need to look at what's the next generation, which means how do we move on, and what about folks who have been in supportive housing for a very long time, and how do we help them move on to the next stage? I think I'll hand it over to Daniel.
Great. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay.
Should I just go?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you. The first two things that I would comment on are somewhat pessimistic outlook on funding availability that's shown in Table 2 of the report, where for each type of funding needed, capital financing, tax credit investments, rental or operating subsidies, and supportive services, about half or more of the respondents felt like each type of funding was less available now. And I'm not particularly surprised by that at all, but it does worry me that the outlook on any type of funding can affect the availability of some of the other funding for these types of purposes. So, for example, we are, in terms of single-site supportive housing anyway, we rely a lot on the low-income housing tax credit program to fund these kinds of projects. And those are resources that are going to be used for affordable housing of one type or another. And the supportive housing field has been pretty adept at getting a share of those resources for homeless people, for people with very high needs and vulnerabilities over the years. And I think that's been a very positive development that's occurred, given that those housing funds are going to be available. But as there is a pessimistic view that tax credit investments won't come forward for these kinds of projects, or that rental subsidies won't be there or service dollars won't be there. It's going to be increasingly more difficult to acquire those kinds of tax credit allocations for supportive housing. And so, you know, the people with the greatest needs are not ultimately going to be getting much of a share of that overall national effort on creating more affordable housing. So that part is worrisome, and I think we need to pay attention to all those elements together to make sure that we keep supportive housing as a priority for a lot of these housing dollars that continue to exist, at least to some degree. And then the other thing, just in sort of a different note, is I was pretty surprised by the portion of respondents that talked about currently using housing first or harm reduction approaches in their support of housing at more than 60%, and actually an additional 15% saying that they're planning to do that in the near future. So that's three-quarters of everybody responding indicating a use of that kind of housing first harm reduction model of supportive housing. And I guess I'm not surprised that there is a lot of focus on housing first. A lot of tenure plans call out housing first as a method to be used, and I think it's largely a positive development, but I don't think we have reached consensus in the field about what actually constitutes housing first. And to some degree, it feels to me like housing first is becoming just a synonym for supportive housing, when really perhaps it's a subset of supportive housing. And we should probably take some time to come to some consensus about what the elements of housing first and harm reduction housing really are, so that we're using these terms to mean the same thing when we talk about them. So those are my overall reactions.
Thanks. And sort of back to your comments about funding availability, what do you think about sort of what Barbara mentioned about sort of the role of Medicaid as, you know, I think the survey was released before healthcare reform, but sort of thinking about that as a possibility for funding services and supportive housing as a way to kind of deal with some of those shortfalls in other areas.
Yeah, I'm excited about the prospect of more Medicaid or other healthcare resources being available for supportive housing, but I think we need to work on making sure that those resources can have some flexibility in what they will pay for. My concern now is that, you know, Medicaid it obviously is a healthcare program, and so it pays for services that really look like conventional healthcare services. And supportive housing is sort of a different critter sometimes than that. A lot of the success of supportive housing in terms of keeping people housed and so forth is tied up in an array of services delivered to people, you know, that include an appropriate attitude on the part of the service provider and engagement activities and a certain amount of forbearance and flexibility in working with people, just helping people deal with day-to-day activities of life. And sometimes it's difficult to classify those kinds of services as true healthcare services that then are eligible to be paid for with Medicaid or other healthcare resources. And so that's something that I think we need to pay attention to when we're looking to these healthcare resources. We need to find ways to make them actually work for the key services we need to be providing to people in supportive housing.
Jackie, this is Barbara. I wanted to comment on that.
That's fine, yeah.
And I could also move on to the next question because I think it would work well. I wanted to, which is talking about innovations.
Right.
I think what Daniel's saying is really very important as we move forward. There is funding out there that can provide services, but as we in the supportive housing industry continue to move forward, we have to be sure we understand, as he pointed out, what supportive housing is and what services we're interested in providing. I think it's important as we start to look at this that we begin to understand how we could use Medicaid funding to do the pieces that make sense without losing that our primary objective is to house people with services, not to have a medical model where services become the priority over housing. And I think as we look, particularly in times of bad economics, as we look for any willing provider or any willing funder, we have to be careful that we keep to the fidelity of the model that's important for the people that we're housing. That's not to say that we shouldn't look at these new funding pieces, because I think it's vital that we do, and I think there are ways that they can be helpful. I also think there might be ways that we as an industry, we as a nationwide movement can help to work with federal government to try to develop ways that we can fund supportive housing as the model that we know rather than adapting it to existing funding. So I think that becomes very important. The other piece is I think we need to look at changes and developments that are going on in HUD and the real push that HUD is seeming to have to start to work with HUD and HHS to perhaps look at the concepts of housing and services together and to be able to push for those models and work better with our housing authorities statewide where the money will be. The other place that I think we need to investigate are these widening populations like criminal justice, many of whom also fall into the systems that we are now working in, where there are other sources of money. And we have to sort of be innovative without, again, changing the model to meet the needs of these populations that easily and should have supportive housing available to them. Daniel?
Yes, thanks. Well, on this question of innovations, that I see as important in the current environment, I'll just go back to what I was speaking about earlier on the Housing First and harm reduction implementations. And I think what is very positive about that, about so many people, three-quarters of the respondents saying that that's either what they're doing or about to do, is that it indicates that these limited resources that we actually have are being targeted to higher needs populations. So, you know, that's, I think, why Housing First and harm reduction efforts are used, or that's who they're used with, are higher needs populations. And given the increase in the use of those approaches, it seems to suggest that, you know, there's more targeting going on, and I think that is a wise thing to do when resources aren't available for everyone. You're going to use them as wisely as possible. And that ties, in my view, to another thing that was shown on the table in the report about innovations, which is the last item, the use of vulnerability indices to prioritize homeless individuals for supportive housing. And close to 20% of the respondents said they're using those, and another 33% said they plan to in the near future. And that's something that I've been fairly close to because our organization has been using a vulnerability assessment tool for a number of years now to identify among the large number of homeless people we know in our community which ones have the relative greatest needs and ought to be prioritized for the limited supportive housing slots that we have. And I'm also aware of another vulnerability tool that the Common Ground organization in New York is using in several locations to identify people at higher risk for mortality as a way to determine who ought to go into some of the housing placements that are available in those communities where it's being used. And, you know, I certainly think that's an exciting development as a way for us to be more effective with our resources to really target them to people with the greatest needs and make sure that we're, you know, applying our interventions with people who are going to probably suffer more without them. You know, it's an exciting era, I guess, and with those kinds of innovations is the point I wanted to make.
Exactly.
If I could jump in, Dan, just to follow up on that, you know, I think I'm picking up that there's a lot of promise that you're seeing housing first and vulnerability indices that are both ways to make supportive housing more available to the higher end need of the spectrum. I think at the other end are the growing movement towards doing homelessness prevention programs and rapid rehousing. And, you know, it struck me one of the quotes that we got in one of the open-ended questions, one of the responses that we got was, quote, supportive housing should not be positioned as either or with other important elements to ending homelessness, such as prevention and rapid rehousing, mm-hmm. but rather as a highly important component within the spectrum of interventions needed to prevent and end homelessness. I'm just curious what your thoughts are. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, as we tend to move towards having a lot of these models and terms out there, housing first, vulnerability indices, rapid rehousing, you know, the level of noise starts to increase in terms of what all of these models mean and how they relate to one another. So I was just wondering if Dan or Barbara, if you could speak to that a little bit of how you work to sort of, in your own community, sort through some of the noise of the models and how people might think that they're actually competing with one another.
Yeah, well, if I could, I'd like to respond by just acknowledging that we need to be careful not to, sort of pit one program idea against another when we're looking at a fairly small pie to divide up. You know, it's kind of natural to go that route, to advocate for whatever approach each of us tends to take with our services to folks, but where I think we need to focus on is how to expand the pie, if you will, and use some of these other resources. Medicaid's been mentioned already, but other kinds of mainstream resources that ought to be helping people in need but who may not necessarily be homeless. So the concern that I've had to some degree is that you know, we see supportive housing as an effective resource for people who have pretty serious problems, and I think that's certainly true. It is an effective resource. It's mostly been used for people who are homeless, and it's mostly been paid for with homeless system dollars. And as we've started to recognize that it could probably be used for populations of people who have similar problems but aren't necessarily homeless, I think we need to make sure that we are finding ways to bring more resources in to pay for it and not just consuming all of the limited homeless resources to pay for the expansions of these programs. And so one example I'll offer from our community is this project we have for folks with chronic alcohol problems called 1811 East Lake, which has been shown in some research to have pretty positive outcomes in terms of major system costs avoided after housing these individuals, and actually also declines in their alcohol consumption. And we're trying to promote in our state that there is pretty clear evidence that the state can save money in Medicaid payments that it needs to make when you house these individuals. And so the state ought to use some of its own resources, be it from the Medicaid pot or general state resources, whichever, to create more of these kinds of programs in more communities in the state, effectively paying for it by these other savings. And that's a way maybe we can expand the supply of these kinds of programs to people without, just continuing to tap into the very limited pool of homeless dollars that are available. But in general, I guess my response is that I think we need to never lose sight of the need for prevention services and other kinds of services, and we need to try to utilize as many system resources as we can to support those kinds of programs.
Let me just reply briefly. I think that often the funding comes to us in ways that makes us often compete with each other for the very small pot. I agree with Dan. And we have to be very careful of that. I mean, part of what has to happen is there has to be the kind of communication that goes on between agencies, both state and not-for-profit, that work with vulnerable populations. We also need to be careful that we provide services that are appropriate for the populations. I know in the state of Connecticut, supportive housing has such positive connotations that everybody wants to call what they do supportive housing because the legislature likes it. And that becomes dangerous in terms of what's being funded and the sharing of resources. And because, you know, the idea of sharing resources is lovely if you had enough of it. But unfortunately, we don't. The other piece, though, is the what was talked about earlier about things like vulnerability indexes and assessments become really very useful when you're determining needs of populations. So, you know, who needs prevention and who needs services really need to be talked about, and folks need to be at the same table as we're differentiating between services. And I know that in our state we're looking at, as we're converting all of the addiction population to Medicaid, keeping some of that money that we're now spending on treatment for things like sober houses and other support services that the population might need, which would mean it wouldn't compete with existing services that are out there in the community. But I think the communication piece becomes very important.
Great. Thank you, Barbara. So I think I'll actually skip the third question,
yeah,
since we already talked about Medicaid. Do each of you want to give just sort of a really brief, I want to make sure we leave enough time for comments, but just sort of any brief sort of final thoughts before we open it up about sort of your overall assessment of the state of supportive housing and where we go from here?
Well, the one thing I would say briefly is that it's pretty clear from the report that supportive housing is viewed by the respondents as still making a whole lot of sense as a homelessness intervention and as an appropriate kind of service for other people who may not be homeless. And so the expansion of it is a good idea, and we need to figure out how, in this economic crisis, we're going to not lose ground. That's the thing I worry about. But we should certainly celebrate the idea that it's still a great idea.
I would say that I'm delighted that we're at where we're at in spite of these economic times. I think all of us should feel very good about what's happened in the last couple of years relative to supportive housing and how far we've come. I think we need to, as a community, keep it going and work on the next stages of supportive housing and do it together. And we need to work together to provide some leadership to both the state agencies and the not-for-profit agencies as we move forward.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to both of you. So, Wendy, I think we'll open up the lines at this time for questions. Do you want to review that process of the question and answer period?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. Again, that is star and then the number 1. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a tone acknowledging your request and a prompt to record your name. Your first question comes from the line of Jean DeMaster.
Hi. I'm just wondering if you're seeing any differences with the Vulnerability Index or with any of the other assessments in terms of Housing First or harm reduction between the various populations of homeless people, singles and families, survivors of domestic violence, youth. Are you seeing differences between the populations?
Richard, do you want to take that question, or Barbara or Daniel? I'm not.
I'll take a stab at it. I'm not sure if I understand the question exactly right, but I think with the vulnerability indices that I've seen, both the one that Common Ground has been disseminating, it was really developed by Jim O'Connell out in Boston, and as well as the one that the Downtown Emergency Service Center has developed, both of them look at targeting the subset of homeless or long-term homeless people that are either at high risk of mortality or that are particularly vulnerable due to their difficulty with functioning. And that's not to say that it doesn't capture people who are also survivors of domestic violence or who have been encountering other public systems. And, in fact, I think the Common Ground tool does include those individuals who have been frequently hospitalized or involved in other emergency services. I think the general premise behind both of those tools, as well as some of the other models out there that target people not by vulnerability per se, but more by the cost and their level of involvement in public systems, I think they're all trying to get at the same idea of reaching people who are at the highest end of the need, really starting, and I think it's a reversal of the traditional way of solving policy problems, where we look at the easiest part of the problem and we start there. Here we're saying let's start at the hardest part of the problem of homelessness and look at those particular subsets. And I think to the extent that those really high-need folks do overlap with some of those other public systems and services that people are involved with, I think it does capture that. So I'm sure if that quite answers the question, but
I guess the issue for me is how do you compare the vulnerability index for singles in downtown versus the vulnerability of young children, living in a campground with no electricity and no plumbing? I mean, how do you get to those differences?
I think the vulnerability indices could be used for a variety of populations, from what I can answer. Maybe Dan could speak to that a little bit. But, the folks who get picked up by the tool that Common Ground uses tend to be older, just because they are looking at people who are at higher risk of mortality. Dan, yours may actually pick up some younger folks, but also because younger folks and people who are leaving the DV shelters and others may have not had the chronicity or the length of stay in public institutions, they might not be quite as have as many challenges with functioning. But I think what the idea is the idea of targeting people who are at the highest end of that. And I think even with young adults or youth who are on the streets, they may also there may be a subset of those young adults or youth who are high users of public systems and who are particularly vulnerable. And I think the premise of targeting the highest end of the need should apply across all these different subpopulations.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just another word on the DESC vulnerability assessment tool. It's designed to take a look at various domains of of life and functioning for any given homeless person, and sort of produce a final score that can be used to compare against other people. It was created in the context of serving a chronically homeless population, so it may not be ideal in other settings with, you know, other specific subpopulations like domestic violence victims or others like that. But it is designed just to get a look at an individual to compare against other individuals who've also been assessed.
Let me just add that I think one of the biggest gaps that is needed right now is develop similar targeting tools for those other populations, in particular vulnerable families. CSH, that is something that CSH is interested in and looking at is how we can take some of the existing tools that are being developed around the country that try to look at the most vulnerable subset of homeless families as well as families who are unstably housed in other kind of residential settings and look at, you know, how do we identify those families who are most vulnerable and who do need a permanent supportive housing intervention in order to permanently exit homelessness as well as to increase family stability. And I think that's, you know, again, this is not to say anything against the existing vulnerability indices so much as to say we need a similar kind of tool for the family system.
Yeah, and Richard, I think it in some ways goes back to the comment you made about the quote that, you know, supportive housing shouldn't be positioned as an either-or, and I think these populations shouldn't necessarily be positioned as either-or either. It's just a matter of trying to figure out who among them, you know, makes most sense for supportive housing.
But this may tell us a piece that's missing as we move on to be able to have a tool that would look at these populations.
Exactly. Okay, should we move on to another question?
Your next question comes from the line of Laura Hens Russell.
Yes, I wanted to ask about both the operating fund side of the supportive housing financing as well as the capital side. And we've been doing some work on elders and the cost of living for elders, and some of the, I think, the principles apply across the range of different supportive housing targeted populations. And so there's both the challenge in getting capital funding, but also given the fiscal environment in the operating funding needed. And one of the strategies we started to look at is whether there might be a way of creatively finding a way for SSI payments to inch upward so they actually begin to cover market rate rents in different communities. So in Massachusetts, we have a state supplement, but it's been, you know, fixed and flat for many years, and it's still not sufficient to rent a unit. There are higher levels for assisted living and some of that. So I guess, you know, one question is, do we try to get just more housing, more targeted housing subsidies, and or can we look at perhaps another wrinkle into the SSI payment standard that might actually cover rents and that could be paid to the organization that's running the housing? Do you have any thoughts on that?
This is Barbara. Let me say that I sympathize with you. And there are some of us in certain states where the cost of housing is so high that the SSI payment doesn't come near. And we in Connecticut have precisely the same problem that you have in Massachusetts. This is an ongoing struggle. I mean, obviously the ideal solution to this is more subsidies. But I don't, I mean, I would encourage anyone who can to see if we can raise the SSI payments, but I'm not sure, considering the economy right now, that the federal government is going to be particularly inclined to raise SSI allocations. But I do think that working more closely with our housing authorities and using more of Section 8 that can be targeted, I mean, I know there's a NOFA out now that's a non-elderly disabled NOFA. We're trying to work with our housing authorities statewide to be able to target our folks, particularly to get them to target homeless folks. I just think we need to be as innovative as we can and to target as many places that have subsidies as possible.
Great.
And I think the other part of that is, I think the instinct has been always to look at finding more subsidies, and I think there's been an increasing shift towards scattered site approaches in most communities
yep.
doing supportive housing. And I think, as much as we love scattered site programs, we think that they are normalizing for tenants. I worry a little bit about the fact that ultimately by focusing on purely scattered site models, increasing rental subsidies, and really kind of subsidizing the kind of the demand side of the market, we're not necessarily increasing the supply of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why, the Corporation for Supportive Housing has always been focused on kind of dual approaches, both scattered site as well as single site approaches, where we're actually developing new supportive housing. And the real premise is that, we know that the quickest way to get people into housing is often through a rental subsidy, renting an apartment in the private market. In some levels, and in many communities, that becomes kind of unsustainable, not only because of the limited number of subsidies, but also because of the high cost of rents. And so the amount of money that goes to subsidizing those rents becomes very challenging, I think. So I think it's really about how do we diversify those approaches, and to the extent that we can increase tenant incomes, I think the more those rental subsidy dollars go further within any community.
Great. Thanks, Richard and Barbara, and thanks for your question. I think we have a few more minutes left, so I think we have time for one more question.
Our next question comes from the line of John Malloy.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit here in Los Angeles that is busy trying to build permanent supportive housing for the formerly homeless. And we have a pipeline of projects that we maintain that's fairly active right now. And our experience is that we're having more luck on the construction side than we are on the services side, mm-hmm. to the point where our pipeline is kind of outstripping our foreseeable ability to bring in services money. And I don't know whether to put on the brakes with the construction side or to forge ahead, bravely assuming that the resources will ultimately develop. And I was just wondering about some thoughts or observations on that. Hello?
Any thoughts?
I'll give it a whirl. I think some of it depends on the needs of the clients you're serving. I mean, I know in California there's some services in your mental health community that if these are folks that would be appropriate, that are not only folks who are homeless but folks with mental illness, that there are ways of linking with the appropriate state or, in your case, I guess, county entities that might be able to supply housing because you're providing housing for their clients so that they would provide services. I don't know if it's possible. It might be possible in my state. I'm not sure it would be possible where you are. But it's a question of identifying, are there existing services in the community and are you providing housing for those folks that would fit within that category? I don't know if that helps at all.
Well, I mean, we're closely aligned with the local Department of Mental Health.
Yeah.
Trying to get them to prognosticize on the resources that are going to be available going forward has
been hard.
Yeah, it's an imprecise science at best. And,
yeah.
And we find ourselves maybe in the fortunate position of having more product than we can provide services to, but, I've been trying to think that we'll just move forward with the product development and do our best to backfill with funding, whether it's through these new ideas that have been talked about here in this conference or not.
Well, I mean, I would hate for you not to go forward. but I think that the issue that you bring up is a serious issue everywhere. I think the issue of where we're going to get services, and how we're going to get them when you have housing is a very serious and ongoing problem. Let me just throw one thing out that we're starting to look at here that might be useful. The question is, what services are being delivered now and how long and how much service somebody needs for what period of time. And by that I mean, is there a way that we can do beyond the vulnerability ongoing assessments so that people can move to lower service levels so that existing services can provide services to more people. Let me just throw that out as another piece we would like to do in the next year.
I think your question also is speaking to something that Dan touched on earlier, which is that funding for supportive housing is ultimately the sort of, to use a couple of tired analogies, a kind of three-legged stool or a house of cards. You sort of need all three pieces of capital operating services for it to work. And whenever one of those pieces is not, if there's some uncertainty around availability of it, it becomes really difficult for people to take a leap of faith. And I think that's the position you're finding yourself in. I think, you know, interestingly, this is a time where people are really looking at some innovative ways to provide services within supportive housing. There's some emerging the work that's happening around how to link to federally qualified health centers as a way to at least provide some of the sort of health care and wellness supports for tenants, if not also the sort of the case management that helps provide that glue for people. But, you know, I think that I would say, you know, at the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, just, you know, you stick with it and I think just keep your ears to the ground for new ways that services can be brought into your housing.
And just try to convince those of us in state government that you're actually housing our people.
Right. I mean, one final thought from me is that what we're concerned about is that, you know, everything being called supportive housing these
yep.
days, and, you know, if we're pushing forward on projects without a full complement of support services, we run the risk of, you know, falling into that category.
Yes.
If I could, I know we're almost out of time, but Barbara, if you could speak very quickly about the new legislation that was passed around frequent users in Connecticut and how that's actually helped perhaps revive a little bit of the availability of funding.
Yeah, we are doing a project that started in New York called Fuse, where we're looking at folks who are frequent users of the homeless and criminal justice system, as well as our Department of Mental Health and Addiction system. So we're literally targeting individuals who've used all those systems, and we're putting them into housing. We're beyond that, though, that spurred the conversation to talk to legislators at looking at Department of Corrections money that's not being used to target individuals that are both frequent users and leaving the criminal justice system. And this year, we have a $3 million allocation that went into a very difficult budget to target precisely those individuals. So sometimes there are ways to look at existing state budgets, particularly Department of Corrections budgets, which often have a huge amount of money in them in most states, and see if there are ways of targeting some of that money. I mean, so these are just some thoughts. I mean, we were really very lucky this year to be able to get that kind of money.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I know we're a little over time, so I want to thank our presenters, and especially Barbara and Daniel, for being on the call today. We really appreciate your thoughts and knowledge about the supportive housing industry. And thanks to all of you who participated.
Thank you.
I think that'll end our call.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.